@gmail.com, or call me up afterwards at the front desk, 231-8032. Thank you so much for listening. I will put this up on the website with all these connections to these articles and these organizations. Get involved. It's time. Stay tuned.
2 miles down the Delaware shore, there were geese in the marshes out looking for food. They got stuck where they stood in the oncoming crude, and it's oil, oil, drifting to the sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Aurora Colony Vineyards 2015 Jazz Festival, August 9th, with doors opening at 2 p.m. and performances from 3 to 9 p.m. The Aurora Colony Vineyards is located at 21338 Oak Lane Northeast in Aurora, Oregon. Performers include Tony Lincoln, the Ron Steen Band, Picante Latin Jazz, Tom Grant, and many more. Again, that's the Aurora Colony Vineyards Jazz Festival, August 9th, from 2 to 9 p.m. More information about directions and ticket prices can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Ooh, what a little moonlight can do.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Up next on Political Perspectives, we'll hear a presentation against the death penalty given at the annual meeting of Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty in June. Keynote speakers were actor Mike Farrell, who you may remember as Captain B.J. Honeycutt from the TV series MASH, and Becky O'Neill McBrayer, who lost both of her parents to murder.
Believe it or not, an organization that addresses one of the saddest and most serious experiences in a person's life, nonetheless brings people together in a way that helps them to find joy and hope and solace in one another. Murder Victims Family for Reconciliation, or MVFR, is an organization of over 4,000 members across the country who have experienced the devastating loss of a loved one to murder. In spite of that terrible tragedy, they speak out against the death penalty. They show up at legislative hearings throughout the country and are persuasive in their statements that executions are just another act of violence and do not honor our loved ones. Some of those very important people are with us tonight. One of them, Becky O'Neill McBrayer, has agreed to share her story. She is the director of programs at St. Andre Bossette Catholic Church. Becky doesn't know this, but she is my soul sister. She holds a BA in theology from Bellarmine University in Kentucky and attended the Women's Campaign School at Yale. In addition to serving as a labor, civil rights, and political activist and campaign manager, she has run shelters and recovery programs, including co-directing the St. Francis Dining Hall until 2013. Please join me in welcoming Becky O'Neill McBrayer.
Well, good evening. Thank you. I'm so proud to be an Oregonian, and I'm so proud to be an Oregonian for Alternatives to the Death Penalty tonight. It's a real honor and a privilege for me to be surrounded by so many abolitionists. You chuckle, but for me this is very serious. It is a true honor. Thank you. I want to thank our board chair, Ron Steiner, for inviting me to be here tonight to talk about my experience as a murder victim family member. I'm honored to know Ron, and we are so fortunate to have him here in Oregon. He's been a tireless advocate for abolition, and he's worked so much on behalf of murder victim family members nationally for years. And so I just want to thank Ron for all of his support to me personally, for helping to lift my voice, and for being a true national leader in this movement that is gaining momentum day and day and day after day. It's my understanding that Ron is some sort of executive in retirement, but I found him to be a really trauma-informed, a beautiful person, exactly the kind of person that if you're in my place, this is who you want to support you and to help lift your voice. And so I want to thank Ron for helping to lift my voice this year. I also want to reach out to anyone who has lost a loved one to murder. Anyone who's lost a loved one to murder and is here tonight, I want you to know, if you don't already, you are not alone. And I would love the opportunity to meet you after the event. If you're able, please come seek me out. I'd really like to meet you. This is a really tough journey to talk about. It's my living nightmare and my most personal and tragic loss. So I have 10 minutes to speak, and I really have to stick to my written notes or else I get lost in my own story, and no one here wants to see that. I think about the last 10 minutes of my mom and stepdad's lives. I can't imagine their fear and their suffering. Their anguish is part of the reason why I oppose capital punishment today, why I'm a member of OADP and MVFR, Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. 9 years ago in April, my life was devastated by murder. My family was completely devastated. And now that I've had this horrific experience, I feel compelled to speak out against this broken death machine that we call capital punishment. And to address the myth of closure, which is oftentimes a false promise of prosecutors and proponents. So let me please start from the beginning. I grew up in a loving, privileged Catholic family in the small country town of Corbett, right there at the foot of the gorge. You know you all wanted to grow up there. My folks had 5 kids in 7 years, so when I say Catholic family, I mean Catholic. My dad was a Portland firefighter. He was a commercial fisherman. He was our hero. We played year-round sports, and my mom somehow not only managed to get us to all the practices and the games, but she cheered us on at every single sporting event. In fact, she was our number one cheerleader in life. And my mom taught us at an early age that two wrongs don't make a right. So we commuted the 20 minutes into Portland to attend Catholic school. We went to summer camp. We enjoyed amazing family vacations on the Oregon coast. My 4 brothers and I, James, Andrew, Joshua, and Joseph, we were a team. We called ourselves a team. I was the best looking of the team, for sure. And the smartest. But our family was pretty normal, including my parents' divorce when I was away at college. Now, my fellow abolitionists, the story turns a little sad here. My youngest brother, Joey, he'd become increasingly odd as a teenager, and it progressed well into his early 20s. Now, our family didn't know much about mental illness, and in the final week before our family tragedy, even with some red flags, we really didn't know how to help Joe, even though we were trying. In that final week, Joey was 25 years old, undiagnosed, untreated, and totally full of rage. On April 7th, 2006, after being unable to reach my mom and stepdad, my brother Andrew and I drove to their home in the Charbonneau district of Wilsonville to check on them. We entered the house and began calling out their names. There was no response. The ensuing experience will haunt me for the rest of my days. We ran out of the house through separate doors, and I called 911. Mom was 55, Craig was 60, and they'd been... They'd been both brutally stabbed to death 17 times each the previous morning. So in our darkest hour, I watched yellow crime scene tapes around us, as well as a media helicopter and a host of reporters. The entire street was lined with law enforcement. My brother collapsed, and I became so weak in the knees that I needed assistance to a bench. Please don't ever forget that those are real people on the evening news. So this was just the beginning of a long and painful journey, one that's now become a journey of hope for me. We lost these two beautiful people to aggravated murder. We lost my brother to mental illness and the system. And then we were threatened or tempted, I'm not sure which, with the death penalty by Clackamas County prosecutors. One prosecutor told us, your brother is exactly the kind of person the death penalty was designed for. My brothers and I were divided because capital punishment divides families. And at a time when we need each other the most, when would we be able to start healing? Now I want to share with you what it feels like to lose loved ones to murder. I want you to understand that there isn't really any closure. Most murder victim family members balk at that word. The concepts of human pain, mental and emotional anguish, deep, deep suffering, complicated grief, devastation, anger, darkness, these all fall short. It took my brother Andrew and I 8 years to even talk about our shared experience of entering that house with our dead mom and stepdad. It took me nearly 9 years to talk about this issue publicly because it's so painful. I wouldn't wish the immense pain of murder onto another single human being ever. And I wouldn't wish it onto another family either. Killing the killer doesn't bring anybody back. It doesn't solve anything. It protects no one. But what it does do is create more victims, family members of those who are executed, those who are murdered by the state, with a great deal of premeditation. My heart really pours out to these families because I understand the pain of losing loved ones to murder, and I also know the pain of having a brother who's a murderer. Do we truly understand what we're doing to family members in the name of justice? The truth is, what many murder victim family members truly long for is some measure of resolution, not closure. My mom and stepdad were brutally murdered, and I remember this every day. My really sick baby brother, he's serving a true life sentence. He's never getting out of prison. He's there every day until the day he dies. And I remember that every day. So there's closure in things like real estate deals. We might have some real estate agents in the audience tonight. But closure doesn't really apply to the human heart. And why would we even want to permanently close the door on the past as if it didn't exist? No. We honor those memories. So closure is a myth, and it's oftentimes a false promise of prosecutors. Life in prison without the possibility of parole, now that sounds like some measure of resolution. I recall sitting in the judge's chambers with two ADAs in Clackamas County and pleading for my brother's life. I said, please don't kill my brother. Please don't try to kill him. Our family has had enough death. So for us, life without the possibility of parole was at least resolution to the judicial part of homicide. After only a year and a half of pretrial hearings, my brother Joseph was sentenced to true life. We were spared a trial because of a plea agreement. I think of the many people, all those family members who spend years, decades, involved in death row cases, reliving the nightmare again and again. I still relive, but I never have to step foot in a courtroom again. What really moves me from my dismal experience is that every person who is executed has their own family members, people who are innocent of the crime their relative committed, who will now grieve forever. So every execution leaves another family grieving and without any societal support. Tonight, I stand in solidarity with these murder victim family members. So let's just drop this unrealistic idea of closure and instead turn our attention to actual healing and growth. Murder victim family members can process our pain and move to deeper levels of healing. We can direct that pain into meaningful activities which actually honor our loved ones, like me being here with you tonight. We can even learn to smile again, breathe again, sleep again, and love life again. But you know what? Killing the killer won't achieve any of these things. Sister Helen Prejean one of my heroes, the Catholic nun who wrote Dead Man Walking, reminds us of something that I believe about my brother and that I believe about each and every one of you gathered here tonight. Sister Helen says, we are worth more than the worst thing we have ever done in our lives. So let's take the money we waste on our broken death penalty system in Oregon and instead invest into things like serious crime prevention or real assistance for crime victims or critical mental health services. The list of alternatives is endless. My mother taught me, and I still believe, two wrongs don't make a right. So, my fellow Oregonians, let's please be one of the next states to say, not in our name. Thank you.
I now have the great honor of introducing our keynote speaker. I grew up watching MASH. It was the only television program my parents allowed to be on during dinner. And I loved B.J. Honeycutt, who was so often, alongside Radar O'Reilly, the moral compass of the episodes. Of course, Mike Farrell is not only an actor, but also a talented writer, director, and the reason for his presence tonight, human rights activist, or as he would have it, citizen. He shares my passions for reading and road trips. He is an environmental and animal rights activist. He's also my union brother, having served several years as first vice president for the Screen Actors Guild. In short, he gets it. We're all in this together, and we are capable of amazing compassion, like that Becky O'Neill McBrayer has shown. For more than four decades, Mike Farrell has been engaged in prison reform and advocacy. In the 1970s, he began working with the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons. The experience there led him to visit Tennessee's death row, where he had a revelation about prisoners that many people in this room have had, one that too few people have the opportunity to reflect upon until we have the conversation with them. In Mike's words, they had done terrible things, of course, but that wasn't the sum total of their existence. They had children and mothers and fathers, wives, brothers, and sisters. They felt things and hoped for things and wondered about things just as we do. The only difference was that they were living in cages and knew they'd never get out of them until the day they were marched to the electric chair. Just Call Me Mike, his autobiography, is a terrific book, and you all should read it. And you should donate the royalties to OADP. At the end of the book, he writes, love, respect, and attention are necessary food for the human soul. There's a lot of love and respect in this room tonight, so let's now give our attention to Mike Farrell.
Thank you. This has been a wonderful experience to meet all of you. I speak to lots of groups, and not all of them are as compatible and compassionate. Not all of them are as in as much agreement. So it's a great pleasure to be here for any number of reasons. I've been involved in trying to end the use of the death penalty for well over 30 years now, and I'd like to begin my presentation to you by offering a couple of brief snapshots. I've been thinking about them lately, and I thought it would be instructive in a way. Because I had made a statement or endorsed an ad or signed a petition about being opposed to the death penalty, perhaps all three, it was known that I opposed the death penalty. And being a member of the cast of a popular television show, while at the same time being outspoken on social issues, sometimes caught the attention of the media. That being the case, after the Supreme Court established re-established the death penalty in 1976. Gary Gilmore died by firing squad in Utah. John Spenkelink was electrocuted in Florida. I was asked by a minister from Nashville, as was suggested, to help him stop what he called a potential bloodbath. Joe Engel is his name. He's a minister of the Church of Christ and has been an active, dedicated abolitionist for longer than one can understand sometimes. With Joe, I visited, as was suggested, my first death row at Tennessee State Prison, and despite my long-held opposition to the death penalty, I remember having some concern upon entering the facility about how I would feel around what we had all been told were savages, slobbering, fang-toothed, child-eating monsters. But what I found there were men, mostly minorities, who were uneducated, frightened, some uncommunicative, others longing to talk, some angry, some despondent, many morose, almost all grateful for the attention. And that experience began a journey that has provided me an education about our country, its laws, and its criminal justice system. Later in Virginia, I met a young man who was scheduled to die for a crime he had no memory of committing. I learned he suffered from alcohol and drug-induced blackouts, a condition resulting, one assumes, from the horrific physical and sexual abuse I later discovered he suffered as a child. He had awakened from a blackout to find two women friends, roommates, murdered, dead, horribly murdered, and assumed, since he thought himself worthless and evil, he must have done it. So he turned himself in to the first policeman he saw when he got off the bus and was tried and sentenced to death. Evidence later discovered by an investigator demonstrated that he was not the perpetrator of the crime, but the laws in Virginia at that time precluded the possibility of presenting new evidence in a case already adjudicated. So we fought for years to stop the train racing him toward the execution and finally succeeded, at least in part. In 1991, hours before he was to be electrocuted, Governor Wilder commuted his sentence. Relying on the arguments we had made, he did so on the basis of what he called, in the commutation papers, possible innocence, and commuted him to life in prison. Life in prison for a possibly innocent man. Today, 34 years later, despite our continued efforts to get him a new trial, my friend Joe remains in prison. An attorney I met in that case later asked me to come to Oklahoma to help him stop the execution of a man by the name of Robin Parks, a black man he believed to have been wrongly convicted. Unable to get a meeting with the governor, he asked me to take part in a press conference about the case, hoping it would embarrass Governor Walters enough to force a meeting. It did. After meeting, the governor still refused to intervene. So we drove to McAllister Prison, where Robin was to be executed that night. Once given the news, Robin was gracious, thanking me for trying to help him. We were, of course, separated by a pane of glass, but he put his hand up against the glass, and I did the same, a way to shake hands without actual contact with a condemned man. Oklahoma killed Robin that night, and one of our team who stayed with him until it was no longer possible to do so called me the next day and said that Robin had asked him to thank me again for caring enough to be there. He said it meant more than I might ever understand that I had cared enough to show up and try to help. Another time, Amnesty International asked me to come to Utah, where William Andrews, another black man, was to be killed. They'd been unable to get a meeting with the leaders of the Mormon Church or the governor, and Andrews' mother wanted the chance to speak with one of them. They thought I could help, and in fact, I was able to meet with some of the church leadership who said they had no place in the discussion, the law, it was a matter of law. But we did succeed in getting Governor Bangerter to agree to meet with William's mother. She and the lawyer and I sat with the governor in his office. She was an extraordinary woman, I think, who remained calm and courteous as she asked, She did not beg. She asked him to intervene and spare her son's life. We told him that William had taken part in the crime, a robbery, but he was outside the building and did not know that his partner inside had killed those under his control. Plus, we talked about the fact that a sketch of a gallows with a stick figure hanging from it was found in the jury room with a legend scrawled at the bottom that said, "Hang the nigger." We thought a new trial appropriate. I will never forget Mrs. Andrews' dignity and her courage as we left that room, knowing the governor would do nothing. And the governor did nothing, and William was killed. In Nebraska, I sat in a room waiting for Willie Otte, another black man who was to be the first person executed in that state after the death penalty had been reestablished. Otte had maintained his innocence for 15 years, for the 15 years he'd been there on death row, waiting. And when he walked casually down the hall, unescorted, to the room where I'd been given the opportunity to sit and wait for him, he came in, sat down to talk to me. I was rather surprised, given the extraordinary security measures I'd experienced in other institutions. We had a significant hopeful conversation, after which I left thinking that perhaps the relaxed atmosphere and the attitude of the staff toward Willie meant that there was reason to hope. But walking Willie Otte, Harold Lamont Otte, was electrocuted. And when he died, there was a crowd of Nebraskans outside the prison walls screaming, "Fry the nigger." Now here I want to God bless Ernie Chambers, Senator Ernie Chambers, whose 40-year struggle to end the death penalty in Nebraska finally succeeded just last month. For years now, I've been referring to the death penalty as the lid on the garbage can. I believe that once we get rid of the lid on that garbage can, and we will, once we take that lid off, we and the people in this country will be forced to look into the rotten, stinking, maggot-infested mess that is our criminal justice system. Yes. And do something about it. Almost 20 years ago, learned of the case of Guinevere Garcia. I don't know if any of you remember the name. This is a young woman who was sentenced to death in Ohio. Gwen had been when she was a toddler was her mother throwing herself out a window to her suicide. Gwen was raised by a grandmother and an uncle, the uncle who fondled and abused her for years, giving her alcohol to calm her and shut her up. The grandmother was aware of what was going on, but did nothing. By 16, Gwen was an alcoholic and a prostitute. By 17, she was pregnant and had a baby, Sarah. Sarah was not yet 1 year old when Gwen was arrested and the Department of Children's Safety was about to take the child, and they were going to take the child to live with the grandmother and the uncle. Rather than allow that to happen, Gwen suffocated her child. She was put in prison for 10 years. She got out, married one of her tricks who genitally mutilated her with a broken bottle. Drunk one night, she shot and killed her abuser. And she was again sentenced to prison, this time to death. She spent a significant amount of time on death row and finally became a volunteer. She said, "I don't want to do this anymore. Kill me." And some of us felt that this was simply not acceptable. I organized, along with a lot of other people, organized a campaign to Governor Edgar at the time to stop the execution of Guinevere Garcia. And because of the notoriety that was brought to the case, he did. He stopped it. He commuted her to life in prison without the possibility of parole. 10 years later, a reporter went to that prison and talked to a young woman, because there were a class of young women who had gotten schooling and were being given awards for graduating in the various courses that they had studied. And she was very curious about it, and she asked this young woman, why you've been in prison for most of your life, you've come from the kind of circumstances we all know about, why did you do this business of going to school? And she said, we were scolded and taught and yelled at and scorned until we did it by Granny. Granny is Guinevere Garcia. Guinevere Garcia provided enough energy and enough love and enough attention and enough caring to those kids to make them make their lives better. This is the woman who was nothing, had nothing, and wanted to die. But what we find is that the human spirit has the capacity to reinvigorate itself and mean something, even though she will spend the rest of her life in prison. Those familiar with the practice of capital punishment in this country, its logistics, its implementation, and its politics, know it is racist in application, is primarily, if not exclusively, used against the poor and the poorly defended. It is, due to the complex web of laws associated with its use, far more expensive than life without parole. And it entraps, savages the lives of, and sometimes kills the innocent. Cameron Todd Willingham, Carlos de Luna, Troy Davis, Ruben Cantu, three of them from Texas, and perhaps, according to Judge Stephen Reinhardt of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Tom Thompson of California, are names we should keep in mind about people who were in fact innocent of the crimes for which they were executed. The system is grinding forward slowly, and it's grinding up human beings as it does so. Today, Albert Woodfox, the last remaining incarcerated member of the Angola Three, was to be freed. A judge gave him leave to be freed, but the state of Louisiana appealed the judge's action, and we found out today that Albert will be in prison at least for a couple of more months while that appeal is adjudicated. Anthony Ray Hinton, who was just released in April after 30 years on Alabama's death row, said, "You have to understand something. These crooked DAs and police officers and racist people had lied on me and convicted me of a horrible crime, something I didn't do. They stole my 30s, they stole my 40s, they stole my 50s. And I could not afford to give them my soul. I couldn't give them me. I had to hold out. I had to hold on to something. The only thing that kept me from losing my mind was my sense of humor." He said, "One of the white men that came to carry me to jail said, 'Oh, I don't care if you did it or didn't do it. You're going to pay for it.' I said, 'How is that when I haven't done nothing?' And he said, 'Well, let me tell you, on account of your black, you're going to have a white lawyer, a white judge, more than likely a white jury, and you have a prior conviction for theft of property. You know what that spells?' I said, 'No, sir.' He said, 'It spells conviction. Conviction, 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 conviction.' The system is racist. It victimizes the poor and the disenfranchised. It's hugely, grotesquely expensive. It ensnares and kills the innocent. These are facts. We know it. We know that there are 153 people now who have been tried, convicted, sentenced to death, and ultimately exonerated. What we don't know is, beyond the ones I've named, how many went through that process and were killed. Justice Scalia wants to insist there are none. These facts, and they are facts, not opinions, are known to those on both sides of the issue. They are mostly rationalized and argued, even sometimes accepted by proponents who perhaps even in spite of personal discomfort prosecute death cases because they say it is the law. When debating or discussing the death penalty, one often hears the sentiment expressed by a supporter, if someone killed my loved one, I'd want to kill the son of a bitch myself. Now, I understand that. If someone were to savage and kill my wife or daughter, I'd want to strangle the bastard with my bare hands. The immediate, urgent desire for revenge is natural, I think, and completely understandable. But if one were to do so, there would be consequences. If one did that, there might be prison time. Depending on the circumstances, perhaps a murder charge. Conceivably, another execution. So we rein in our outraged response and turn it over to the state to do our killing for us. But what is too often glossed over in that equation is that there are consequences there, too. For me, that's an aspect of state killing that is not often considered and is rarely discussed. It is the inevitable, inescapable consequence associated with the taking of a human life, the price paid by those who do the deed, and the cost to the society that uses it, the society at large and its members. Not the economic cost, the moral cost to all of us. At the founding of this nation, some extraordinarily idealistic premises were propounded. Today we hear a lot about the founders, what they did, what they said, what they meant, but I wonder how many of those who cite them know that one of the best known and most literate of our founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, wrote this before it is said he shed a tear when signing our first Constitution. Franklin said, I confess, I do not entirely approve of this Constitution at present, but, sir, I'm not sure I shall never approve of it, for having lived long, I've experienced many instances of being obliged by better information or fuller consideration to change opinions even on important subjects, which I once thought right, but found to be otherwise. So much in my view for the Justice Scalia and the so-called originalists who claim to know and intend to preserve what they want to believe the founders meant when drawing up these documents. Mr. Franklin went on to say, for when you assemble a number of men to have the advantage of their joint wisdom, you inevitably assemble with these men all their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. What we know is that the founders based the legitimacy of their challenge to the crown very carefully. They articulated it in what were then quite revolutionary, original, and what are now thought of as quintessentially American concepts like the separate and equal station of the people, the notion that all men are created equal, and that all are endowed with certain unalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What we also know, given the benefits of history and hindsight, is that despite their success in articulating these brilliant concepts, I think it's important to note that our founders' reach exceeded their grasps. As Franklin suggested, as a result of the context of the times and the mindset of the men who proposed them, prejudices, passions, errors, and selfish views prevailed. And in spite of all the quite extraordinary vision they articulated, they established a nation whose power was vested exclusively in white, property-owning men. Great they were for their time, and bless them for what they accomplished, because despite the limitations in their own ability to fully comprehend and actually make real what they had made possible. Whether they realized it or intended it or not, they in fact left this extraordinary platform, this trove of explosively powerful concepts for those of us who followed. The challenge inherent in the legacy of the founders, in my view, is to fully realize these ideals that were left to us in aspirational form. Our founders probably did not consider the hopes, dreams, and expectations those principles engender in the hearts of those left out. But the ideas, the seeds, had been planted. And once planted, they were nurtured in the hearts and minds of slaves, of women, of the non-white, the poor, the incarcerated, and the condemned. Some of the founders' failings have since been addressed and remedied, at least in part. Women now vote, but they still struggle for fairness, for recognition, for equality. The freeing of the slaves was certainly not then intended. As great a mind as Thomas Jefferson's thought it was unwise because of the differences, their color, their lack of mental capacity, and his awareness of their potential danger, his concern about the, and this is a quote from him, 10,000 recollections by the blacks of the injuries they have sustained. Of course, the slaves were eventually freed, but because a serious national effort to solve the racial divide, a kind of national truth and reconciliation process, was never seriously pursued, the vicious horror of racism cuts away at the vitals of our society today. And of course, the state continues to arrogate to itself the power to violate that which our founders declared unalienable, the right to life. In my view, our challenge today is to fully realize the ideals inherent in those wonderful, revolutionary, quintessentially American concepts. And people of goodwill do work every day. Many of the people in this room do work every day to fully flesh out the promise they implicitly offer to women, to people of color, to children, to the poor, to the disenfranchised, and to those whose sexual orientation is outside the established norm. But I believe a critical point has been missed. I believe we imperil ourselves and our nation greatly if we do not understand that at the core of all of these rights, all of these struggles, is the demand that we honor and value all of our fellow citizens' unalienable right to life. Dr. Benjamin Rush, one of the men who signed the Declaration of Independence, founded the Pennsylvania Prison Society. He believed the death penalty had a brutalizing effect and argued then that the practice of organized, ritualized state killing actually increased criminal behavior. 200 years later, Professor Gary Potter of Eastern Kentucky University testified to that state's legislature, saying studies of capital punishment have consistently shown that homicide actually increases in the time period surrounding an execution. He said social scientists refer to this as the brutalization effect. He said executions desensitize the public to the immorality of killing and legitimize the notion that vengeance for past misdeeds is acceptable. President Jimmy Carter, in his recent book, A Call to Action, says when governor of Georgia, he saw that the tacit acceptance of bias, discrimination, and injustice creates an underlying tendency toward violence or abuse in a society. He then realized that the normalization of violence committed by the state encourages violence in society. And he said, if the government easily chooses violence and punishment to solve problems, the people will internalize this choice, which will influence how they deal with each other and how they make their way in the world. Violence has an impact beyond the obvious. Carter says young people in the military, if our military is called upon to commit unjustified violence, this will influence the thinking and behavior of highly impressionable service members and those who are just beginning to live independently and exert themselves in a highly charged environment. I read that and then thought of Abu Ghraib and black sites. What's clear to me is that human beings are killed in death chambers. As human beings are killed in death chambers, the condemned is not the only one who is impacted. Frank Thompson, who was in the room, former warden here in Oregon, then in Arkansas, said, "I realized that I was training decent men and women how to take the life of a human being in the name of a public policy that, after all these years, couldn't be shown to increase the net of public safety." Jenny Lancaster, former warden in North Carolina, coined the phrase "silent actors" to describe the corrections officers who have to physically mete out executions. "There's a code of silence around execution teams," she says, "and it's used to protect people who are involved in them." One of the first wardens to bring awareness to corrections job stress, Warden Lancaster spoke of the isolation that execution teams suffer and asks, "When almost nobody can relate to your job, is it easier to quell your feelings about executions than express them?" Stephen Martin was executive assistant to the director and general counsel of the Texas Department of Corrections. He says, "One execution made me step out of my role professionally and touched me on an emotional level. And I began to realize that this is how these things happen, executions. We do these things personally you would normally never be involved in, because we do them because they're sanctioned by the government. And then we start walking through them in a mechanical fashion. We become detached. We lose our humanity." A 2005 Stanford study entitled "The Role of Moral Disengagement in the Execution Process" determined that the core thesis is that individuals must morally disengage in order to perform actions and behaviors that run opposite and are counter to individual values and personal moral standards. Capital punishment is a real-world example of this type of moral dilemma, where everyday people are forced to perform a legal and state-sanctioned action of ending the life of another human being, which poses an inherent moral conflict to human values. They studied 8 behaviors, which are familiar to some of us who look at these issues. 8 behaviors associated with the process: moral justification, the use of euphemistic language, advantageous comparison, displacement and diffusion of responsibility, distortion of consequences, attribution of blame, and dehumanization of the prisoner. What is clear to me is the brutalization effect is real. And it doesn't only affect guards and prison personnel and young people in the military. It is real, and it affects us all, I believe. Dehumanization is an essential part of the process of state killing. We're told the condemned are monsters. They are nothing more than the worst thing they've ever done. Beasts who deserve to be put down. They've lost their right, that unalienable right that was, according to the founders, endowed by their creator, that right to live. Pastor Jim Lawson, friend of mine and a hero of the civil rights movement and Dr. King's apostle of nonviolence, said, "To claims that these people have forfeited their right to life is to say that God made a mistake." The Brazilian educator Paulo Freire tells us that to dehumanize another is to dehumanize ourselves. I believe that's exactly what we're doing. President Carter saw that accepting bias, discrimination, and injustice creates a tendency toward violence at home. The Stanford study says actions and behaviors counter to our values and standards require moral disengagement. Because we've given the government that power, Stephen Martin saw that we go through the process mechanically, we become detached, we lose our humanity. Our continuing use of the death penalty, the government-approved elimination of a human being deemed lesser, decidedly the worst of the worst, has desensitized us, I believe, allowed us to morally disengage from our instinctual revulsion at such an act. And we've tasked the actual killing to those in our employ and turned our eyes away, pretending it's not we who do this. But our silence gives consent, and the murder continues in our names. Worse, it puts us on a slippery moral slope and opens the door to actions on the part of our leaders, our government, ourselves, that would once have been unthinkable. Consider the following, not just as horrors somehow rationalized and therefore acceptable today, but as the legacy of the death penalty, products of the unconscious process of brutalization set in motion by institutionalizing the taking of the life of helpless human beings. Today, one in every 100 American males is in prison, jail, or otherwise linked to the system. Of them, white men 18 or over are one in every 106. Hispanic men 18 or older are one in every 36. Black men 18 or older are one in every 15. Black men between the ages of 20 and 24 are one in every 9. We in America have the largest prison population in the world. We commit incarcerated men to years, sometimes decades-long psychologically damaging solitary confinement. Children are imprisoned with adults, often suffering sexual slavery. The resume of the greatest nation in the history of the world now includes Guantanamo, wars of choice, shock and awe, first strikes, imprisonment without charges, preventive detention, extraordinary rendition, murder by drone, force feeding, torture, hooding, beating, rectal feeding, assassination. These are deemed appropriate. And at the same time, as we spend billions of dollars maintaining, propping up, justifying, and using our chambers of death here at home, while schools are without books, children go hungry, and human beings live in immiserating circumstances, some of which generate the very behaviors for which state killing pretends to be the remedy, I believe we are corrupting the moral fabric of this nation and its people. We are committing a kind of national moral suicide by accepting the idea that this horror is right, proper, and consistent with our stated principles. And I believe the process begins with denying the fundamental dignity of a human being who, because of the circumstances of a tragic life, a mental incapacity, indescribable abuse, a momentary impassioned lapse, commits a terrible act. And somehow, we've accepted the idea that that terrible act will be healed or balanced by our committing another terrible act and calling it justice. It will not. And I urge you to continue to do everything in your power to stop this awful process before it destroys us all. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:56. We were just listening to a brief presentation by Mike Farrell and Becky O'Neill McBrayer about alternatives to the death penalty. In a few minutes, we will be jumping to flashpoints.
You sit there handing down orders. You examine the terms of the deal. A car is always waiting. Other hands turn the wheel. The doors slide open before you. The doors slide shut behind. Other hands carry your luggage. Weightier matters engage your mind. You take the gold out of the earth. You throw the corpses in. One crop is as good as another, as long as the cash keeps pouring in.
The wheels must never stop turning. The machine must be obeyed. The future has got to be fueled, and there's a price to be paid.
Black like the dust, brown like the earth. This is our land, the land of our birth. Silently digging, digging our graves. Choking our bodies, choking our lives.
Living on scraps, dying in debt, digging in darkness so our children can eat.
Once we were free, greeting the sun, sharing the earth, giving thanks to the corn. Sang with the waters, sang with the wind, danced with the drum, circled without end.
Now we are silent. They have taken our tongues, they have taken our pride, they have taken our songs. Only our bodies, only our eyes, burn with the memory of the old ways.
Brown like the earth, black like the dust. Who can we turn to? Who can we trust?
You've got no patience with failure. You've got no time for delay. Certainty points to the future. Straight lines carve out the way. You never make moral judgments. Only one truth you defend. Money must be free to make money. That's all there is in the end. You take the diamonds out of the earth. You throw the corpses in. One crop is as good as another, as long as the cash keeps pouring in. The wheels must never stop turning. The machine must be obeyed. The future has got to be fueled, and there's a price to be paid.
Brown like the earth, black like the dust. Who can we turn to? Who can we trust? The gun is their god. They have taken our land. They take what we dig. They take without end.
We drown in the dust. We choke in the heat. Our skin grows sores. Our lungs rot. Still we remember the cold clear air, waking at dawn with a morning star. Still we remember the sound of the flute, the feel of the grass under our feet.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Yes Men Are Revolting as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Yes Men Are Revolting is a documentary directed by Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, which follows the comedy troupe The Yes Men as they stage phony press releases and events to bring attention to environmental dangers and corporate greed. Again, that's The Yes Men Are Revolting, Thursday, August 13th at the Clinton Street